All right, good morning. Welcome to the Lightning Talks. I apologize for being late. So this is that what we're going to do today. Hit pause real quickly. This Lightning Talk session is the most ambitious Lightning Talk session ever attempted. We're going to try to do 32 talks in 2 hours and 15 minutes. We have the 3-minute express lightning round that'll be coming up shortly, but we're going to start off with some 5-minute talks. Go ahead and hit play. And can everybody see this unit right here? Okay, you see how it's going from yellow and the green is going away?
Open your eyes, then.
Okay, well, once the timer, this is a timing unit right here, and you can see, some, perhaps not that closely, but there's red coming up from that. When it hits that yellow-amber color, that means the speaker has 30 seconds left. And right about now, we have...
10, 9, 8, 7, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Under normal circumstances, I would have asked for another practice round for that, but we're already running behind and it's my fault, so I'm just going to have Momo kick it off. Give him a round of applause for the first Lightning Talk of the day.
Good morning, everyone. I also have to kind of hurry because I have to check out by the Radisson at 1, and there is a huge queue, mainly the hugest queue I've ever seen at any hotel ever, and it's all your fault, so I'll just start ahead. My talk has kind of a cryptic title, and I don't have my slides on a beamer, but if you put some color into it, you think you can imagine. So it's a mix of DHCP and XSS, so cross-site scripting, but we'll get to that in the meantime of the talk. First off, I'm Momo. You might have seen me at the info desk. I'm one of the Checkspace members. You can find me on Twitter. And also, if you are ever interested in the trademark hackathon bullshit, I'm the guy owning hackathon.de, so maybe it's interesting. First off, I'd like to invite you to a somewhat my event as it happened. I was sitting at my hackerspace, was getting late, I was a bit drunk, and I was thinking, okay, let's go home, let's go catch the last train. And as always, if you're in a hurry, you don't get the last train. And public transport sucks. So I was going back to the hackerspace because home is where Wi-Fi is, and yeah. But something was different at my hackerspace that day. There was not only Wi-Fi, there were new enterprise Wi-Fi access points. And I think I'm not the only hacker if he sees the word Wi-Fi and enterprise, who has the natural attempt to break it. So, thanks. So anyway, I was sitting at the hackerspace and trying to break this goddamn wireless. So I was thinking, what could I do? I know I'm not the hardcore Linux guy or hardcore protocol guy, so I was thinking of boring web security shit. And thanks. So I was thinking, it has a web interface. We could look for a cross-site scripting in a web interface. I don't know, some static XSS or something, cross-site request forgery, SQL injections or whatever. Or we could test the underlying OS. But that's all boring and it's all been done 1,000 times. So yeah, let's think about something new. I was browsing around this web interface, mainly being stupid, clicking around, and I found this beautiful screen. First off, it also has a common field. I put in script alert 1, and I got a beautiful stored XSS, but that's quite boring. On the other hand, you were seeing here the DHCP host name of the client, along with its IP address, the assigned access point, the assigned SSID, and some other metadata. So we have a DHCP host name. What happens if we do this? Is there anyone who doesn't get it? Or whatever, I'll just explain it. We are setting our DHCP host name to an illegal string being script alert 1. So basically, our host name shouldn't even get through the RFC, but our DHCP client allows us to. And we have a payload in it. And guess what? It worked. We just have a beautiful XSS in the web interface. We don't even have to be authenticated. or even better, we don't even have to be in the fucking management network because we're a client. It has to display the client's MAC address, that's all. So, if you're ever gonna attempt this, there are a few things to make your life way easier than I had, because, I don't know, script alerter one is nice, but there's no payload in it. If you might want to, I don't know, have a payload including a dot, maybe an IP address to get your scripts from, try to use dword. If you Google dword and IP address, you'll find a neat converter, basically converting your dots and your IP to some weird string. It's all math and all browsers support it, which is quite nice, and I didn't know of it before. So use dword if you don't want any dots in your IP addresses. And if you're fuzzing around or pen testing those weird things, just always, on every attempt, change your MAC address. Those things tend to try to be smart, to display your host name and whatever, but really it's not worth it. So
30 seconds.
Okay. Yeah, and now what? I've got 15 vendors affected. First off was Ubiquiti. That's their nice CVE. You can't scan the QR code because there's this nice thing, but whatever. I can't get my hand on every shitty web interface that's out there. So please go, all of you, go out and pen test all web interfaces. If you find something, please, please disclose responsibly. I think every security researcher knows how to do that. Let me know, because I'm interested in this stuff, and you still owe me a chunk if you find something. If there are any further questions, mail to me at amethackathon.de, write me on Twitter, or find me at the info desk, and I'm done.
Actually, two quick reminders to all of our presenters who are hopefully sitting in the front row and know which talks are happening before and after theirs. Your slides appear on the screen down here, so you don't need to go look up at the screen to see what's going on, which then cuts off your microphone. Also, please be sure to talk in the direction of the microphone and adjust the microphone so it's pointed at your mouth. You don't need to eat the microphone like this. If you stand back at about this distance or even further from the podium mic, the audio angels will figure it out. So thank you for that, and you're good. Go.
OK. Hi, everyone. My name is Arne. I'm a PhD student studying usable email encryption. And I'd like to tell you something about some of the problems and possible solutions. So currently, most email is unencrypted. Well, maybe some of it is encrypted. But what we want to have is for the GCHQ to go dark. So three problems and three solutions. I'll start with the problem of motivation. So users are generally not too motivated to actually encrypt their emails, and they don't have a lot of understanding of all the actors in the game. So what might we do? I think we should raise awareness by maybe having a crypto hour. So there's something called Earth Hour, where everything goes dark, supposed to go dark, it doesn't. Maybe we should also have crypto hour, where we also go dark for at least one, well, where we try to convince lay people to go dark for just 1 hour. Then also co-design, working with actual users, and having more crypto parties. Then the problem of feedback. How do we actually know that stuff is encrypted? So this is two screenshots of Enigmail. Actually, the left is clear text, the right one is encrypted. You don't really know except for a small little icon, right button, bottom. So also, even worse is Outlook and PGP. If PGP crashes, it just sends your email unencrypted and doesn't actually tell you. So yeah, very fun stuff. So better feedback. This is a screenshot of Mailpile. I think the feedback there is a lot better, but It could be even better, because if we blur it, then we don't really see whether there's encryption happening or not. Then a solution to this is indicators, which should be visible. And we can build that on the principles of Gestalt psychology. Also, we need to look at both positive and negative indicators. So on the left, maybe we can have something like a green background for encryption and a red background for plain text. And also, we should make sure that we don't cry wolf. We don't just scare people for threats that aren't real. Because, yeah, otherwise, they'll just ignore our advice. Then there's also teaching. It can be quite difficult to teach people the basics of cryptography. So these are two drawings by that people drew in a study of mine that I did around a month ago. So this is someone who actually kind of understands email encryption and how the email system works. And then here is someone who has absolutely no clue. So yeah, mail just goes from one point to the other, and it's all magic. Then there's also lots of jargon. So on the left, of course, there is GNUPG, and on the left, on the right, there is PGP. Both lots of jargon, and I think the only place where I've seen normal English being used is in the word list of PGP. Now there's also missing consistency. So on the right, there's the interface for ADMX, OTR. And on the right, there's Milvelope. And the what the button actually, the lock icon actually does is not too clear. It's clear, but it's different in both cases. On the one hand, it starts a key exchange, and in the other, it actually, you select whether to encrypt or not. But even within applications, there can be inconsistency. For example, GPG tools. On the left, when you encrypt, when you send an email, the lock is actually closed. And then when you receive something, it says encrypted, and the lock is open. And that's a bit confusing. And what it actually means is that stuff has been decrypted. So how to solve this? I think we should have interaction language, with one idea being common iconography. So on the left, there's isotype, which was started somewhere in the 1930s, if I'm correct. And on the right, there's the visual language of MilPy, which I think is a very good start. Then maybe we can also have something like the OSI trademark to deal with all the various software that we have. And also building interaction patterns. And maybe we can also have physical interaction patterns. So something like a handshake. Built on contactless devices. Now, also, I think we need to have an interaction architecture because, well, we used to have rudders for cars, but then we didn't really have lots of useful stuff. So, well, what now? If you want to join the conversation, there's the hashtag. I'd like to thank these people, and that's it.
All right, do we have a representative for the Nimrights talk? No, in that case, free software song.
I am.
Are you gonna need your guitar mic'd or no?
I don't think so. I think it's loud enough.
Okay. We'll be sure to stand behind the podium so the people watching the streams can at least hear you.
Okay, so.
I guess I'm going to have to drive these slides, aren't I?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I could run over there.
And now we're in the 3-minute round. So we're going to reset the timer for 3 minutes, and I'm going to try to follow along as best I can.
Has it started already?
Well, I guess we'll start it when you start singing. How about that?
Okay. So, hi, I'm Marius, and I'm going to play this song, the free software song, which has been wrote in the 90s by Richard M. Stallman when I was 5, and it has inspired me much. So, the first round is humming, and then we'll sing together. Mm-hmm. the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free hackers. You'll be free. And now two slides, please. Hoarders can get miles of money. That is true, hackers, that is true. But they cannot help their neighbors. That's not good, hackers, that's not good. When we have enough free software at our call, hackers at our call, we'll kick out those dirty licenses evermore, hackers evermore. So join us now and share the software. You'll be free, hackers, you'll be free. Join us now and share the software. You'll be free, hackers, you'll be free. Thank you.
You ready?
Yes.
Go.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm Jelena from Linux User Group of Novi Sad from Serbia. And we are organizing Balkan Computer Congress. It's Balkan, named Balkan. You can see there. Balkan Computer Congress has been conceptualized as two days gathering of the hacker community international and on focus on this part of Europe on Balkan. So what we are trying to do is make the first part of program like concept of set of presentation, workshops, lecturing on current topics, ideas, technology, privacy, software development, free software, and everything else. So. And the second part of the program will be organized for the hacker communities. So Lunguns is the largest hacker community in Serbia. We are more than one decade we are working together. So our goal is to all communities in the region to put on one spot, on the one place, do they get to know each other, and to meet, exchange knowledge together. So why Novi Sad? Because the Novi Sad is a center of the south province of Serbia. There is a multicultural town, and there is a very active artistic and technology scene. For example, music festival Exit is happening in Novi Sad every year, more than a decade. So that's why Novi Sad we chose. And we are all from Novi Sad. So we are all inviting you to come to Balkan, because last year it was for our first Congress that's happening in that part of Europe, Hacker Congress, the big one. We have more than 3,000 participants, more than 30 lecturings. So everybody who is interested to join us, work with us, have fun, play a lot of parties, and everything else is more than welcome. We will publish our CFP at end of January. So if you are interested, you have something to tell us for the next year. So the dates are 5th, 6th, and 7th September. Next year we'll be in Novi Sad having fun and having parties.
Can you hear me? Okay, hello, my name is Najib. I want to talk...
I just need to fix the display for a quick moment, okay. If that's okay. Okay. Sorry. I won't take it out of your time, I promise.
Thank you.
You take 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and...
I hate all you guys.
While we're waiting, could you maybe tell us something about yourself? Who are you?
Okay. Yes, my name is Najib. I'm a biochemist, but I'm involved in the resistance movement. I promise to finish after 3 minutes.
All right, we'll fix it at the break. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks. So my name is Najib. I'm involved in the resistance against surveillance here in Hamburg, and I want to talk today about the concept of total control and getting freedom through total control. Actually, experience freedom of total control was a marketing slogan introduced by Sony when they tried to market VCR in the 80s. And the idea behind this is quite simple and obvious, because by gaining control about the content, you have the freedom to see what you want and are independent from the broadcaster. But this is not the concept I want to talk about. At the 80s, sociologists have investigated the relationships between the consumer, the media, the broadcaster, and the technology, and they found something very interesting, because control technologies instrumentalize the freedom of choice as a governing strategy. And this is very important, because personal freedom is in this respect a tool which can be disciplined, and which can be also disciplined by influencing and disciplining the media and the broadcaster and the content provider, very important. And as a result, new social arrangements emerge out of the situation that lead to a self-governing of ourselves through technologies. And this is something that is linked to our present time, because if we look how people behave with their smartphones and the internet, we see these patterns already that have been investigated in the past. And what is the consequence out of this? And I think this is the most important part of my talk. We have to be aware that providing the people with information about the surveillance is not enough, because we can reach their minds, but not their gut feelings. And this is something that marketing specialists already know. And we have to approach this also, because desires and needs are directed and are not created by convincing the minds, but by the emotions. And we are in a battle which is quite unfair, because the other side can address very strong feelings like fear and desire for security.
And, 30 seconds.
And I fear that they also address the desire for freedom. And we need to understand this, because people have the perception that they are free when they give some other people the control about over their lives. We see this ancient principle when we look at the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church gets all the sins and gets a level of control by this. And I want to discuss this further with you. Thank you very much.
And it's at this point that I think a very big round of applause is owed to especially the angels working the video for dealing with my dumbass. Yeah, give them a round of applause. And figuring out at the very last minute a way to make both the timer unit and the slides display at the same time. So thank you very much to them. And give the clicker a quick test, because I think it's all good. Okay, great. Now, don't forget, you have 3 minutes. adjust the microphone. You know, your slides are down there. Yep. And I will buzz you. These guys have had two practice rounds, so they're ready on it. Okay. 3 minutes is yours.
Okay. Hi, my name is Obelix, and I do a lot of 3D printing. And I think like every other person, when I started using a 3D printer, I used software on my computer. And last summer at a local hacker event, I went to sleep and I shut down my computer and the print was still running, so it crashed. I talked to somebody and he told me, yeah, use a web server, use a Raspberry Pi and control your 3D printer with it. So he told me about Octoprint, and it's really nice because you can control your printer over the internet. So what are the features? It runs with Python, so you can use it principally everywhere, but the most cool thing to do is use it on the Pi. And you get a nice web interface where you can control speed, you have a webcam, you can upload files and everything, and you even have a user management. So it's you can use it in your hackerspace. You can create users that can only look, or you have users that can even change parameters. Sorry. So here's your screenshot. So one cool thing is that you can upload files to the Pi, or you can even upload them to the SD card in the 3D printer for later use without the Pi. Really cool is the webcam feature. So if you have your 3D printer at work and you go home and lying in bed, you want to see how the print is going, or if you are too lazy to get up to look inside on the couch, you can take a tablet and watch it. And it has a live G-code viewer, so you can see what it is supposed to do and check if it's doing the right thing. What is under the hood? It's written with Python and JavaScript. I can't say any more than this because I didn't write it. It's from someone else. Just wanted to present it. So it has a REST API. You can. This is a work in progress to communicate with it. And it has a nice framework, so even mobile use is possible. To get more information, I can send you to the website octoprint.org. The developer is Fusel. She wrote it, and so you can get more information on the websites about it. If you want to see it in action, I have running it in the 3D assembly. And you have any more question or how to set it up or stuff like this, just come and see me and I can help you. Or just write. There's a Google Plus page and every social stuff, so you can ask questions.
Great. Oh, don't need the clicker.
I don't need it. Someone else will.
And 3 minutes is yours.
Thank you, because I was a lazy ass. I only have one slide. I apologize for this. So I'll make it very dramatic. It all started in a toilet 1 year ago in Finland. A colleague of mine who happens to teach electronics had the idea that since it really took a long time to write a book, but it wasn't that difficult, so he called his friends along and called me, and I called my friends along, and then we had 30 mathematics enthusiasts working in the same room over one weekend. That was a book sprint that had never ever been seen, at least in Finland before, and we all decided to, hey, let's do it all in Creative Commons attribution. That was even a better idea. So what we did, we had researchers, we had teachers, we had students, my personal pupils along, and we used one weekend, and we managed to make open source mathematics textbook for the Finnish upper secondaries, all for free, up for modification, use, and even purchasing and selling them by themselves. We used LaTeX and GitHub to do that. Woo! What we learned was pretty important, because we had our problems. LaTeX wasn't that easy after all for everyone, sadly, although it's superior. So if you're going to make a book sprint, I strongly urge you, get your text site done way early. Get it pre-configured, because you can't spend half of your weekend configuring all that stuff if you want to make a book in a weekend. That's an important thing. Also, it can be done, but you need a lot of people. We had 30 working on single book at the same time. That was pretty much a feat. And what I want to leave you is something, let's say the most important thing I learned. Now that we did a book in one weekend, then we took another weekend and we did the next book. And we've been keeping this up for a year. We've been writing weekends and weekends and weekends. And we get fancy and famous. We get donations, and people are sending us books. Hey, publish this, because a big publisher didn't. And we found out that we can print 2,000 books with fancy color covers, and it costs less than €2 per book. And what are the big publishers doing?
30s.
They're going to sell it for €30. That's not fair. Anyways. My name is on the wiki because I couldn't have it here. I am Jonas from Finland, perkele. And let me altavista that for you in case you won't find it yourselves. Thank you.
You've got the clicker up there? Okay. 3 minutes is yours.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Sriharsha. I'm from TUM, and I'm a developer of the GNUnet project. A problem we face every day is while testing our peer-to-peer applications. Oh, thanks. So what we try to do is we try to test our peer-to-peer software with as many peers as possible, so that we can learn as much as possible from the test case scenario or any bugs which can happen when we try to run with thousands of peers. And So we have this idea of testing with thousands of peers, but we don't really have a compute power to do that on our local hardware. So we try to use some of our high-performance computing systems at our university, but sadly, there we had some restrictions, like SSH was not available for us to run our software. But what we can do run is that we can run MPI programs, but we really don't have MPI software. We just want to run some peers, after all, which are just plain C binaries compiled from C programs. So that's why I started writing this little hack project called MPI Shell. I call it MSH. So you can use it as a remote shell within a HPC system where SSH is not available. It uses MPI communications layer instead of doing a direct network protocol, because this is the only allowed path where the system administrator can guarantee access to you to use the HPC system. And it resolves the allocated hosts, because if you have an application which is using SSH and you try to use SSH with an IP address or a host name, and here at the HPC system, you will often have
1 minute
hosts allocated dynamically. So beforehand, you will not know what IP address you get, and that's going to solve by this MPI shell. Yeah. Other than that, it also includes PTI support, and this is quickly. This is an architecture which I will just explain quickly. The scheduler is something which spawns your job. Execution wrapper is something like the MPI exec, and then you have these MSHD. The daemon services started on each host.
30 seconds.
And the master host, master daemon will start the application. The application starts the MSH. This is a substitute of SSH. If you have SSH, you can use it there. But if you don't have, you use MSH. And you do the handshake at 6, 8, 7, and 9. And then the output and input streams are multiplexed. And that's it. Thank you.
Good to go?
Yes.
3 minutes is yours.
Yes. Hi, everybody. My name is Jens Stomber. I'm a member of the international coordination team of the German Pirate Party. And today, I'd like to speak about the foundation of the European Pirate Party. OK. Just clicking?
Oh, it's the side button.
OK. So the European Pirate Party is simply an umbrella organization that tries to get all European pirate parties under one hood. So, and basically, its purpose is to act in the interest of its members, and that means that it's coordinating efforts between the pirate parties in Europe in a common election campaign in the upcoming European elections, that it's, it promotes the Pirate Party across Europe and also helps you to found maybe a Pirate Party in your country if there does not exist one today. And of course, we are also focused on being a link between members of the European Parliament, like Amelia Anderslotter, and the European Pirate Movement. So we are doing a lot of coordination and being a platform for people that need information, what's going on in the Parliament. And of course, we are also doing conferences and stuff like that. So let me now talk about the program. So what's what is the program is simply the core values of the pirate movement. This is of course civil rights. This is of course citizen participation, open government, transparency. We want a transparent politics, and of course copyright reform, patent system reform, and of course net neutrality, which is a topic that is right now discussed in Brussels, and free and liberal culture. So. Now let me explain to you about the foundation process. So since the April 2012 at the PPI conference in Prague, we've been negotiating for about 18 months with all pirate parties across Europe. Right now we are already in the national ratification process. So we are done until step number three. So what we are doing right now is step number four. German Pirate Party and, for example, Swedish Pirate Party and the Pirate Party in Switzerland and others have already ratified the PPEU statutes. And what's upcoming next is the foundation conference in Brussels, which will be in March. So at the 21st and 22nd of March,
30 seconds.
We will have the foundation ceremony in Brussels. And everybody who's interested in that is of course invited to come around. And if you have any questions, go to ppu.net where you find all the information. And thank you very much for your attention.
Hi, I'm Riot of the Hacker Fleet.
Can we start?
I'll be presenting CAPE, which is our middleware for our various tasks which we are doing. CAPE is a component-based framework with flow-based components. We do this because we have a lot of machine-to-machine control systems and lots of sensors. We still interact with humans. And we're distributed, we have this mesh capability because the hacker fleet is aiming to connect chips together and reinvent the conventional navigation systems which you usually have on board a ship. The concept of flow-based systems is pretty old, but it's been forgotten a little bit. I haven't seen any books about it in German universities, so we're still conquering new land, which is 30 years old. And it has a lot of advantages over conventional programming systems because you have reusability of components, you have a strong graphical development, for example. You can actually visualize what you're doing and work from that visual perspective to really solve your problems. And you can easily integrate other systems. And the whole concept is gearing to or aimed for flowing data, so you can really have some shipbus system, for example, and have the data flow and convert and merge it with some other data and transmit to other ships. That's very comfy to do so. The project is in open development, but very young. I'm right now one of very few developers developing it, so we're looking for more Python coders. A lot of the groundwork has already been done. We have a very strong component system, so you can install components from other sources, for example. It's tightly integrated with Mercurial, for example. But still, there's a lot of stuff to do. The next milestone in January will embrace the flow-based system. So we are actually implementing it by the book, which is from J.P. Morrison, Flow-Based Programming. It's available online. And there's other flow-based projects going on, like NoFlow, which is in JavaScript. If you like JavaScript, have a look at it. You can do lots of magic browser things with it. We're probably going to use it as user interface. If you have some questions, you can ask me via DECT or IRC. We'll have a channel and stuff. The Hacker Fleet is an open source organization, and we're trying to conquer the seven seas and reconnect all the ships and vessels. So we'll build probably the greatest mesh network on the planet if everything goes to plan. Thank you.
Can you just go to the first one?
Yep, it was there. Crap.
Okay.
All good?
Yep.
Okay, 3 minutes is yours.
Hi, my name is Tobias. I guess you all have been using the toilets here. Is there anyone who did not use the toilet? Oh, two. Okay, that's good. Did you like it? I mean, your visit, was it clean?
And
it was awesome. That's good. So, have you been waiting for other people? I mean, a lot? No? That's good. Okay. This is about a project called Shit Happens. And I started this on another conference and years ago. It's unfinished. It's not really started. And it's about tracking restrooms, and it's like those, and also those. But sometimes it's quite easy to go there and do whatever you do, but it sucks. I mean, it's occupied all the time, and you don't know. I mean, you get off your couch and you walk there, maybe it's a long distance, and then you don't know. So it would be cool to know what's going on, and if there's a lot of toilets like there, then that's not a problem. But sometimes it's like this, or it's more open, so you can guess what's going on. But yeah, I mean, that's probably occupied. But you don't know what's going on the toilet, but maybe you want to know. And but what's the benefit? I mean, I want visualizations. There are so many use cases. You can get like graphs of how many people go there, how often, how long do they stay, and I want you to participate on that. And we can really benefit from that. And You can build a community, and then maybe you find out that you have a shit buddy that is always using the same toilet as you, and we can have awards. And if you did not realize this is a serious project, and please bookmark this URL and just contact me if you're interested. Thank you.
Yes, there are many like this.
First, wait, jokes during the lightning talks? No. Do we have the clicker?
It's on the desk.
It's on the
upside down.
All right.
First slide, please. Yep. You're halfway through. Okay.
Yep, 3 minutes is yours.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Charlie. A few months ago, I changed my car, and it came with this really boring old stereo. But the most interesting thing about the stereo is that it can send the currently playing like radio station or track information or whatever to this LCD in the middle of the dashboard clocks. But when you take the radio out, that information goes away, fair enough. So when I changed the radio, I spent a lot of time looking at the pinouts. So there's a horrible mess, really complicated pinouts, but this is the most interesting thing in the pinouts. Pins 8, 9, and 10 here are clock, data, and enablement. It doesn't say what they're for. So I was wondering what this was for, and I figured out it was probably this missing segment of the display. So hooking up to an oscilloscope and logic analyzer, I was trying to figure out, what components protocol here? What's it doing? And is this really for this component? This logic analyzer was really hard to use. It was really old. There was no manual. It had a button on it that said, don't care, which is the best thing about this logic analyzer. So I moved to recording it with a sound card just so I can get this data and I can start playing with it. And with the help of my girlfriend, we were able to figure out that the format for this data. So it looks a little bit like this. There's a bunch of payload bytes. There's a command byte. There's a checksum. It's really simple. It's SPI in only one direction. The messages are 18 bytes long, and the last byte is a checksum. So I wrote a bunch of Python that will listen to the microphones, the stereo microphone on your sound card, will identify these messages, decode them, validate the checksums, and tell them to tell you about them. So this was generated from me pressing buttons on the radio and having them all turn out in the terminal. So that really helped with understanding it. But the next stage, of course, is to generate these messages. So I was using a Raspberry Pi, and I had to buy a logic analyzer. The sound card method was just not good enough anymore. So this is the first picture of replaying the radio's data back through the Raspberry Pi, but doing all of the generation and checksum calculation myself. This was the first arbitrary text that we got in there. Thank you. So there's... yeah, so there's some alignment issues, but for a first message, not too bad. This is how much data we have to play with. I don't know why it's only 15 and not 16. There's a bunch more work we need to do with this. This is one I took a few days ago. But also, note the difference between these two. This is lowercase, uppercase, lowercase. So the lowercase characters are all used for the special characters. So there's clearly not much memory available for this. So I haven't mapped out the character space yet. It's more work to do. The next most sensible thing to do was clearly to make a kernel module for this.
Thirty seconds.
There's a bunch of shell scripts in Python for the camera system and all that running on this Raspberry Pi that's hidden under the dashboard. And all of these things just send text. They just echo it into proc, and it turns up on the dashboard. All of this code is out there, and this should work on any modern, like Audi, Skoda, Volkswagen, or whatever from the last 10 years or so. Mine's 12 years old, so it should work on yours. Thank you very much.
Okay, that last talk just reminded me that all of the lightning talks are being translated. or at least they were up until that presentation. So could we have a huge round of applause for the translators? All right, 3 minutes is yours. Go.
Okay, hallo. Mein Name ist Mona von Fernopoli. Was ist Fernopoli? Fernopoli ist ein Online-Marktplatz für alle als faire Alternative zu den bestehenden Online-Marktplätzen, die es momentan so gibt. Wir sind ein Sozialunternehmen und auch ein Open-Source-Projekt, was auf GitHub zu finden ist. So sieht der Marktplatz im Moment aus. Kann man sich auch auf fernopoli.de live angucken, ist noch sehr stark in der Entwicklung, wird noch sehr, sehr viel an Features kommen. Wodurch zeichnet sich Fernopoli aus? Es sind im Grunde drei Kernelemente. Einmal ein faires Unternehmensmodell, was dahinter steht, Förderung von verantwortungsvollem, nachhaltigen Konsum. Und wir wollen auch einen Beitrag zur Korruptionsbekämpfung leisten. Wie sieht es aus, das faire Unternehmensmodell? Wir haben uns als Genossenschaft gegründet. Wir haben es Genossenschaft 2.0 genannt, weil wir die Technologien aus dem Web 2.0 mit der Unternehmensform Genossenschaft verbinden wollen, in Form von Online-Generalversammlungen. Wo wir Tools benutzen wollen wie Autocracy. Konsequente Transparenz. Wir wollen versuchen, so transparent zu sein, wie es irgendwie möglich ist. Zum Beispiel, indem wir unsere Konten offen führen. Unsere Geschäftskonten kann man über das Open Bank Project einsehen. Unser Code ist komplett auf GitHub zu sehen. Und da ist es auch noch ziemliche Pionierarbeit. Also da ist es ziemlich viel Arbeit, wirklich konsequent transparent zu sein, haben wir festgestellt. Fairness nach innen, nach außen heißt letzten Endes, wir wollen natürlich unsere Mitarbeiter irgendwann mal fair bezahlen. Und wir sind gerade ein Startup, deshalb ist es im Moment noch nicht möglich, aber es ist auf jeden Fall das Ziel, und oder überhaupt faire Löhne zu zahlen, auch uns selber, und auch nach außen faire Partner zu finden und auch für die Gesellschaft an sich möglichst sich fair zu verhalten. Verantwortungsvoller Konsum, wir fördern fair gehandelte Artikel, gebrauchte Artikel und stellen auch Infos zu nachhaltigem Konsum, also faire Alternativen sollte es sie geben zu konventionellen Produkten. Versuchen wir darüber zu informieren auf dem Marktplatz, Korruptionsbekämpfung versuchen wir so umzusetzen, dass es einmal das faire Prozent gibt. Das heißt, es gibt keine Einstellgebühr, aber Verkaufsprovision. 7% davon gibt 1% immer als Spende an NGOs, die sich für Korruptionsbekämpfung einsetzen. Im Moment Transparency Deutschland. Optional kann man bei Artikeln auch sagen, ich spende einen bestimmten Prozentsatz noch an eine NGO meiner Wahl. Das ist optional. Genau, die
30 Sekunden.
Idee hinter der Genossenschaft ist letzten Endes, dass Fennopoly vielen gehören soll, soll durch viele kontrolliert werden und wir wollen komplett auf Großinvestoren verzichten, deshalb kann man maximal 10.000 Euro einlegen. Wir haben bereits 1.000 Mitglieder, genau, schon relativ viel. Das ist unsere aktuelle Crowdfunding-Kampagne, da könnt ihr gerne mal schauen und es weiter verbreiten, mitentwickeln, euch registrieren. Ja, genau, vielen Dank.
Just a quick reminder, as a speaker, please look at the screen below you. Not, don't turn back towards the projector. Thank you.
Ready?
Yeah, 3 minutes is yours.
Hi, my name is Kupor Wo. For the last 2 years, I've been in Iceland doing a lot of things. And this is an update to a talk that happened last year, which was What is Up in Iceland 1. This is Hvernig gengur Íslandi 2. So I've learned a little bit of Icelandic since then. Where we left off last time, we were about to run the pirates in the elections in Iceland. I'm skipping. What, where is Iceland? Iceland's located in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean. It's a little bit larger than Ireland. Why should you care what's going on in Iceland? Because a lot of the things that are happening in Iceland affect everything that we're doing out in the world. How do I advance the slide here? On the slide side? Okay, cool. So, elections went well. We got 5.2 of the vote. We needed 5% even to get people in the parliament. We got 3 people in the parliament. This is Jonthor Olafsson, Birgit Jonsdottir, and Helgi Hrafn Gunnarsson. We have city elections in April. We are polling currently 10 or 11%, which is quite well. There was a lightning talk yesterday by Pedro from Open Press, and that hit the news feeds over in Iceland, I believe, last night, and that's probably going to help as well. We'll see. City elections are a lot different. The mayor that was famous in Iceland, Jandar, is not running this year, so that may affect the elections there. Other developments that are happening in Iceland that I talked about last time were the very fast low latency cable to North America is happening. It got funded. Vodafone is a major player that bought in on that cable. It will be 10 times as fast as the fastest cable we have going to Europe right now. IMI is still alive and kicking. There are projects that are planned for IMI. Smarty McCarthy is very involved in IMI and started IMI, and now a lot of the people that are along with a pirate group are interested in seeing IMI to completion. The new constitution, unfortunately, in Iceland is pretty much sunk unless there's a massive vote by a large percentage of the population. So there's a small but growing IT startup in Iceland. That means a lot of money is coming into the country. A lot of interesting people are showing up in the country, like the MailPile team that's in Iceland, and they're floating around the conference here. There's been some interesting developments with low-cost electricity and Bitcoin mining that just happened about a week ago in the New York Times. So that should be a very interesting development because Iceland's already got currency controls going on, and Bitcoin is pretty frictionless between currencies, countries. This is my contact info, shit. And if you have questions, just hit me up. Thanks a lot.
Okay, this presenter, so the general rule of the lightning talks, if you've been following this program for the last couple of years, is that I'm generally pretty strict about the rules unless I somehow screw up. And this is one of those examples where I realized maybe 5 minutes before I took the stage that I couldn't get this presenter's presentation to work on my hardware. So we're going to make an exception to the rule that says that all slides are preloaded and run off of one machine in advance. And so I'm going to do my best to try to kill time while they bring up the presentation on the video display that's coming out of the podium.
And funny noises.
Wait, where were the funny noises coming from? Can I make any funny noises? Where were you guys at like 5:30 this morning? There are a lot of funny noises going on then. I'm not so sure that I'm in the disposition to be able to do that. But yes, if we could possibly... Do I have the what on that?
I'm so sorry.
Ich glaube, es liegt eher am Audio-Video-Team. Das sagt ja immer noch nichts an.
The question was, do I have the app for funny noises on my phone? And I just got some updates for apps that I don't remember installing, so...
Als zweite Zahl stehen.
Pwned. And yeah, are we... Do I need to give the video over to her, or are they going to...
You give it over.
Oh, that...
Can we switch it? Is it there a switch here? To the video? Do you have the...
I can give it to you, but it's not going to be long enough.
Oh, I mean, is there a switch, something?
Ah!
Again, huge round of applause for all the pros that end up working in this room, making up for my last minute screw ups.
Yeah, okay, micro is working. Hi, 3 minutes is not a lot. I'm Lena Simon, and I'm working for Commons Machinery. We want to support open licenses. If you are using free licenses, you might have encountered some problems with proper attribution. So, for example, if our photographer, Joey, puts his pictures under a free license, we can all profit from his work. But if, like Emma, for example, really wants to do that, she can put, she can put her the picture on her blog, and of course, she's a good girl. She attributes according to the license, but she has to do that manually. We think that the more we attribute, the more creators will be encouraged to share their work, but attribution is really exhausting and drudging. So everything is very complicated. It's too complicated to keep track of all the different licenses and information. And as a private user, we usually don't have our personal legal department at home to make sure that everything is right. Today, almost no CC license is attributed correctly. And it's of course, because it's very confusing. But why bother thinking about that? This is work that could easily be done by software. So imagine you have a catalog with all the information about the images, texts, and so on that you ever used and reused and created. This catalog could be integrated into your creative tools, making it easy to find, use, attribute, and create new works. This could work like an automatically inclusion of the accurate credits into your work. We would be using metadata for this, and
it
would be easier to find your work and to attribute it. And you even could get a notification that your work has been used. That's what Commons Machinery wants to do. We want to make sure that the context of a work is persistently associated with the work itself. Let's bring licensing into the 21st century and make it usable for everyone instead of worsening copyright law. If you're interested, we have a mailing list, which is about licensing with metadata. You can write me an email to sign up for that, or you can visit our website, commonsmachinery.se, and sign up for our newsletter. Thank you very much.
All right, easy PGP sharing, PGP key sharing.
One quick announcement first. An unsere deutschen Zuhörer und Zuschauer, ihr könnt euch eine Übersetzung des Übersetzungsteams anhören unter DECT 8014. Dankeschön.
Hello.
Yep. Don't forget, slides are, you can see them down there. You adjusted your mic, and 3 minutes is yours.
Hi, I'm Brennan. I'm the UX designer guy from the MailPile team. And my goal is to try to make PGP and sending encrypted emails really, really easy so normal people like my mom can start sending private messages with me. The problem with this is that good UX design is less complex, number of steps required, the better. And it's not really about making a button that looks really pretty and straightforward, because a lot of times the problem is steps. It's like, how many steps does it take to do this, this, and this? There's no magic button that's going to solve and make PGP easy. So the problem really is, how do we transmit a user's public key in a way that is easy, requires few steps, and is verifiable? That's the part that is really like a mindfuck of like, how do you do this that's actually secure and actually easy? And I kind of came up with this idea the other day, and I was like, oh, cool, I want to do lightning talk about it. So the PGP keys, as most of you know, are huge blobs of cumbersome text. And at MailPile, we're going to start attaching PGP keys by default to outgoing mail. So that's going to help with proliferating keys throughout the general public. There'll be all these keys everywhere, all over the place. But and that's a really good thing. But a lot of those keys, most of them, in fact, are going to be unverified. So there are some solutions for this, such as receiving a fingerprint in real life, which some people do. They put them on business cards. I received probably like 10 here at the conference. And that's great, because I know what that is, and I know where to navigate through my program to figure out how to add that and verify. And OK, great, now I've got a verified PGP key. But as soon as you start telling a normal person to do that, it's like, 5 steps later, what program are they going to use? What box? You can't exactly tell because you don't know what hardware they're or software they're on. What, like, sure, you're using Mac PGP for Mac Mail or Enig Mail or whatever. So, and it requires reading and transcribing a bunch of little numbers between two screens and going. And it's very mathy, or not mathy, but techie. So, a better solution to put a QR code on a business card, and in this QR code. We could get about 311 characters at the most optimum setting. And if you can read it from a card, why not on a screen, such as a laptop, so you're at a conference, you show somebody your screen, such as this, it has your info, it takes they take a picture of the QR code. You can even go phone to phone, and in that QR code, there'll be your name, email address, PGP fingerprint, or a key server URL and fingerprint if the length of the data is too long. And then that QR code data is transmitted securely back to your user's address book on your MailPile node or any other application. This isn't something that is just going could be specific to MailPile. It's a user interaction flow that could be adopted and used by many different applications. And it could make the idea of like a key signing party extremely easy, because you could just anybody that a friend of yours knows and trusts, you could scan multiple things, swoop up the fingerprints, and call it good. It's a 3-step flow. Meet person, scan QR code, saved contacts.
Hello, I'm David. So you want to write a Tor pluggable transport. What is a Tor pluggable transport, and why do I want one? Let me show you an example. This is what the beginning of your traffic looks like when you connect to normal Tor. As you can see, it's actually TLS. It's a TLS client hello. You can see in here some distinguishing characteristics, for example, a list of cipher suites and this kind of characteristic randomly generated server name. Unfortunately, these distinguishing characteristics also make it easy for sensors to block Tor, to find out that you're using Tor and block all your traffic. And sensors do, in fact, block Tor in exactly this way in a lot of places in the world today. On the other hand, let's look at what your Tor looks like when you turn on something called Ops Proxy. At this point, all the sensor sees is a bunch of random bytes. There are no byte patterns to look for and identify that you're using Tor. Ops Proxy is, in fact, the way that many people in the world right now are accessing the Tor network in places where it would otherwise be impossible. So this may literally be a lifesaver in some cases for some people. Ops Proxy is wonderful, but it doesn't do all the things that we want. And this is where you come in. Here we have a block diagram of the Tor pluggable transports infrastructure. Slightly simplified, but not much. You can see that Tor client talks to some code that you wrote. Your code does something magical. And then your code again talks to a Tor relay. This something magical, the sky's the limit. It's only limited by your imagination. We have proposals right now to send Tor transport over SSH, or send Tor over Git, send Tor over HTTP, UDP, all sorts of things that we think will make it hard for sensors to block Tor. We also need transports that do clever things like randomize packet lengths, randomize packet timings, because these are also things that are characteristic of Tor and make it easy to block. Right now, we have all the infrastructure in place to do these pluggable transports, and we're looking for creative ideas, and we need your help.
1 minute.
To make Tor pluggable transports work, there is like a little protocol that you use to talk to Tor, but you don't have to worry about that too much. We have libraries for you to use. If you're interested, Google these words, and you can find out more about it. We have libraries right now for Python and Go and C. To find out a little bit more, download the slides, because these are hyperlinks, and they'll take you to some more information. We have a wiki page that tells you the current state of the art of pluggable transports. There's a specification right to the mailing list if you want some more help and you want to get in touch with developers like me and others. And every 2 weeks on Friday, we have a meeting just for pluggable transports in the Tor Dev IRC channel. We're looking for a good few good hackers, so come hack with us.
And 3 minutes is yours.
Thanks. Hey there. My name is Tobias. I'm looking like the guy who did the shit happens, but that's another talk. So this is about Umweltzone, low emission zone. I guess there are people here from Hamburg and they don't know a heck about Umweltzone because they don't have it. And there might be people riding a bicycle. But if you want to leave, stop. Because there are always relatives and friends who visit the town, and they will ask you about where's this Umweltzone, and that happened to me. So if you want to download the app, it's an Android app, it's free, it's open source, and we set that up, a friend of mine and I, within 1 month, and it's on the Play Store, you can download it, and there's also a repository where you can have a look at the code or work on it, send pull requests, whatever. So the app is quite basic. It's just a screen, a map that shows the Umweltzone of a city, and you can pick a city. Then there's additional information whether this regulation is going to change in the future. And of course, there are FAQs where you can look up about this whole topic, whether your car is affected or restricted to enter a certain area. And we kind of looked for data that is officially published. And you can have those wonderful PDF files where they scan old map data and draw the zone on, and it's on low resolution, so you kind of have to guess where the zone is. And I also asked for official information at the government, but said it's meant for orientation, but not so this way. So this is another one, and thanks to OpenStreetMap, we have some more cities that people put in there, and they're wonderful tools where you can grab the data with. So that's it. Tell your friends. I mean, if there's anybody visiting you, you might have a problem finding the zone. Thanks.
CADnode, going once, going twice, and Slavomir. No. He asked if there was any problem with two of them being on stage at the same time. And as long as you can share the microphone, which means you're going to have to cuddle at the podium a little bit or swap off.
Hey, do you hear me?
Okay, 3 minutes is yours.
So if Kat wasn't there, so it means we have 6 minutes or not? No, all right. Never mind then. 2 minutes, okay.
You give up easily. I was about ready to let you have it.
So 5 minutes.
Let's stick to 3 minutes because actually catch up. So, go ahead.
All right. So if we're ready, hey, my name is Slavomir, and here's Justin. Hey,
hi,
say
everyone.
Hi. We are the guys who are organizing the Confidence Conference, a conference which is held in Krakow. And if I can use the pointer. All right. So the Confidence has been organized for almost 10 years already. We've already had 11 editions. This year, in May, we're going to have a 12th edition. And to sum it up, what the Confidence is about, it's an IT security conference for about 400 people. We've been doing it for the last couple of years, and since every year we're increasing the number of technical presentations during the conference. Then we organized the first conference in 2005. It's been organized in Krakow, and as you may see, there was one edition in Prague and one in Warsaw as well. But we try to stay in Krakow every May, which is basically the switch between the. It's almost as hot as during summertime, so it's a really good time to go to Poland. And by the way, somebody doesn't recall, Poland is the country next to this. Why do I say that? Because it's super easy to get, for example, from Berlin or from Hamburg to Krakow. It actually takes 6 hours because we eventually made it. We have the highways in Poland. So we can really go pretty fast to Krakow and visit us at the conference. So what's the conference about? So the conference lasts 2 days. Usually we have one or two tracks. Most of the presentations are heard in English and all of them are super technical. Basically the topics we cover are starting from the really down hardware layer and are ending at the secure architectures and web services, and in between we have some exploits always presented at the conference. So the technical parts are really awesome. You would have to see it. And then, what can you see here? We always try to pick up a really interesting place for the conference. For the last 3 years, we've been doing it in the water pumping station. You may see the pictures. This year, we're gonna use an abandoned hotel for that. And there's something we've been doing for the last 2 years. We call it the extraction point. Together with the core group guys from US, we are organizing a game, a spying leaf game, where you can sneak. Then you can use ASG guns. You have to shoot the leaf targets, which are like calculating points and every minute. Then you have to use your lock picking skills. Then you have to, at some point, freak a phone so that you can contact the base. You are doing every game in two teams, in teams of two. And you have the guy who is like walking around as a spy and the cooperation person who sits at the office. Then you have to break into surveillance systems. So if you're lucky, we're gonna run it for the third time this year. And the contact. So right now we have a call for papers open and there's a registration is open. So if you're up for visiting Krakow, just hit it up. The 27th, 28th May, and the contacts are over there. Thank you.
And oh no, that actually, we've been at this for a little more than an hour, so we're just gonna take a quick break, but we will be back here and go straight on until 3:00. So come back in about 6 minutes and we'll hear Stitch's great presentation about awesome retro. Thank you.
After what you did yesterday, this is a cakewalk.
This is here, yeah.
Exactly. Hello.
right, ladies and gentlemen, if you could please take your seats. Before we get back to the awesome retro talk, and just as a reminder, we're going back into 5-minute lightning talks this time, but the three-minute express round was an experiment this year, and I think it went off pretty well. So could we get a round of applause for all of the great all of the really awesome talks, and I believe that except for a couple of submissions which came in at 2 a.m., some of which were obviously not serious, we managed to get everybody who wanted to give a lightning talk in this year. And that's a first for the full lightning talk, so a huge round of applause for that. Just a couple of quick reminders. The lightning talks are being translated. I really hope that we have the audio from that, because that's going to be... I can't wait to hear what they did with some of them. There's also a declaration. John Perry Barlow at the 20C3 issued a declaration of independence for the internet, and we decided that we're going to try to update it this year. So if you would, please check out the pad at that address right there. And finally, because the Lightning Talks, there's so much content in a relatively small space, to help people who are going to work on the video afterwards to make sure that you can find the Lightning Talk content that you want to find, please check out this pad at this address right here. If you're on your laptop and you can help out, just describe what's going on with the talks, give some keywords and things like that. It's all on the pad right now. Could we get a huge round of applause for the three people who worked on that for the first session of the Lightning Talks? And without any further ado, Stitch, you ready to go?
And I prepared for 3 minutes, so it's 2 3-minute for me.
I sent you an email saying that you had 5.
Oh.
And just so that we do a quick review of the other things that I mentioned in the email, you've got the clicker, everybody figured that out. And actually, a huge round of applause for the video guys who figured out how to put the time unit on the screen, full size, so that you can see it. Another round of applause for those guys. I just love how awesome these guys are and how they make every effort to make this really, really awesome, despite everything that I do to prevent them from doing so. So with that ado, you have 5 minutes, Stitch. Are you ready to go?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Go.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Stitch. I'm one of the guys from Awesome Retro. We are dedicated a non-profit organization to bring retro gaming to all kinds of events. You might have seen some projectors and Segas and Nintendos and seen the world's leading security experts playing video games. we're an organization that's based in the Netherlands. We have currently 50 volunteers, just had our first anniversary, made this awesome 3D printed 2D objects, Space Invaders, very nice. And I want to show a few things that we do and say what we are currently doing and begging for your donations, because we are a non-profit and working very, very hard to make awesome things possible. So an overview in a little time. This is some slides of the crew. On a large dance event, you see those Tetris blocks. We made 6 of them, one by one cubes. A lot of engineering went into that. It's really nerdy. It's like you can have the same clods, same sizes, same frames, and make all 6 shapes of them. So that was really nice. You see a large Nintendo controller on the roof of the tent, and you see lots of cool people. We visit about 15 to 16 events every year, and furthermore, we lend all kinds of retro gaming gear to, if you have an event and you want to do something with retro gaming and you're also a non-profit, just drop by, send an email, and you can pick it up and use it at your event.
So we have this mission, retro gaming for everyone, and everyone is a lot of people. we're also here, as I told, you see these projectors, they are starting to die after 4 days. slowly. They're still usable. And in the front you see this Nintendo table, and this thing works. It's like you can play with two players, the game Mario Brothers 3 this time, and you can see a lot of people fail at this game. It's really nice to see coordination, and I didn't see anyone beat the game yet, so there's a challenge for you. The third level. Ah, no one. Oh, I'm disappointed. The current record is at the first castle, but nobody beat that yet. So, some lies. We currently have 49 consoles that were donated, and those are complete with all controllers, all cables, preferably original stuff. We have partial consoles, so maybe one cable or one controller of something, and we have a database with 433 items. We try to have as much statistics as possible, but due to the time frame, I make it a little bit shorter. The oldest console is from 1973. It's, I think, a Philips VideoPak. It's I think it's a Pong console. Yes, it's a Pong console. The newest is screwing up our statistics, but we bought it just because it should be hacked. It's a kiddies video game, and it should have other more violent games on it. So, currently we have this rally, a donation rally called Donation December. I encourage everybody in this room and watching this stream to check your attic. See if you have got some retro gaming stuff that you didn't touch or see for years. That's the stuff we give a second life, and everybody can use that.
30 seconds.
These are some pictures. We got a donation from Finland, all kinds of Dreamcast gear, old school audio cards, stack of Xboxes and everything. Send an email right now if you have some stuff laying around. You really help everybody. And, thank you very much.
Hi. Okay, hello, I'm Lars Fischer from, during my days I work at the University in Siegen, and I'm talking about a project that is more or less night and day of me sometimes, because it's a little bit too cool. I'm here on vacation, that's why there are no icons on the slide that state where I'm coming from. The project is called Physical Objects Sneaker Transport and has been conceived in a way, I think, 3 years ago. That doesn't mean it's too far gone now, but meaning we're still developing it. The thing I want to do there and here is to make all of you into postmen and postwomen, meaning I want you to transport physical objects. That's the title, obviously. What's the thing here? Thank you. Okay, a little bit about the idea. The idea was conceived when Aram Bartol introduced his dead drops. You probably all know these USB sticks, and the idea was that you can somehow store data on it, and so completely anonymously exchange data. So that means you're storing data there, taking data with you, meaning making these things and yourself into mobile storing and forward devices, transporting data. That is actually not a really new idea, but we thought we can do this with physical objects. And that is not a new idea again, because everybody of you is transporting physical objects from one place to another. What we want you to do is handing them over in between so that they can reach beyond your transportation range, being transported by somebody else. And that, again, is nothing new. It's called co-presence networks and is researched, kinda throughoutly. Not too much. There's another guy from the university in Darmstadt here who's working on something similar here. If he's here, I'm interested in meeting you just after the talk, probably. Okay. The main advantage of this idea is not only that it is a completely distributed network that we're building here, and that we're building something that is censorship hardened and so on, and is by that quite cool. The cool idea, the cool thing too, is that it opens up a lot of problems that are not only interesting for transporting physical objects, but are also interesting for, well, anything else, if you like so, if you want to have distributed networks. You have to need provide some kind of transport security. For some kind of transport security, you need some kind of authenticity. If you want to stay distributed, then you have some kind of distributed authentication schemes. If you are dealing with other peoples and you're dealing with locations, you have a huge location problem because you have always to disclose your location to everybody else, which is, well, probably not what you want to do. And there are problems that we are trying to solve on the way. We already have created some kind of a demo to just check the basic feasibility. That is also not really that new. We just used the random waypoint simulation. We have green dots, that is you moving stuff around. We have red dots being stuff, and the lines are just somehow showing off the destinations of people and of objects. And the purple objects are objects. And we found out that, well, stuff can be moved away at a really strange cost. You have something like a pass dilation of, well, factor 20 or something. Yeah. Good, I'm here. So, to provide at least some structural basic security and basic privacy on the way, the core idea to provide is the negotiation protocol. If we do routing in a way, we always have a routing protocol. What we are doing here and what is new is that we negotiate routes. We have don't have some router who is for himself just stating something like, all right, I have a packet, I have that ports and that ports, and I just can run them there. We have two people, and they have to negotiate the routes, and you see some kind of circular structures with maybe and yes, no, should we hand over the goods or not. The idea in itself, if we at some point in time will be able to provide this, we won't provide it via this small cell phone that you're carrying around, because it's kind of tedious to talk to everybody else. Where are you going? I'm going to there. And if we finally can have it, you have some kind of automated transportation system that is somehow usable in infrastructure poor areas and, well, usable to somehow transport contraband. You probably might be might realize that this experiment is well, I'm too slow. Okay, is in the making. Please contact me if you want to know more.
Iterity is in C. What is that? Where's the clicker?
Okay, wait, we're going to need a do-over on that one. Pause, reset the time. All right. Good, now you can go.
Iterity is in C. What is that? Are we go? Is this going off my time?
No, it's, you keep your time.
All right. Well.
The fail just never ends.
All right.
That I think that's a very appropriate title for what's just happened in the last two minutes.
What?
Okay, can we reset the clock again? Okay, fingers crossed, third time's a charm, 5 minutes is yours.
Try again. All right, iterities and see what? Iterities are an API aimed at input processing. It has its origins in functional programming, and as such, it makes heavy use of first-class functions, so it was a little bit of a challenge to transfer the concept to C. but the motivation is to provide a high-level and formal way to describe in code the behavior of I/O, what input to accept and what to do with it, and to do this for the code that is still, for better or worse, being written in C. So as an example, here's the main part of a program to count the number of words on standard in. These highlighted things would be low-level iterates defined elsewhere. Drop WS would drop any white space from the beginning of input. Drop word would drop any non-white space. Count will simply take all its input and return the number of elements in the stream. So these iterates, each one has a result. This can be null, as would be the case with drop WS, drop word, and by extension also word underscore that you can see there. Now these highlighted things would be standard functions provided by the library. Bind underscore simply runs its two arguments one after the other. Decode runs its argument repeatedly and passes via wrap the stream of results to, in this case, count. So count receives for each word on the input one value of null, and counting those gives you the number of words, right? So going on, enumf will enumerate, as it is called, the file standard in and pass it as a stream, again via apply, to the iterate we just defined. So this is where all the actual work happens. And finally, finish signals the end of input and extracts the result. Now, as a benchmark, I ran this against a list of about 14 million passwords. Compared to WC minus W, WC minus W takes 3.8 seconds. My initial naive version took 9 seconds. I got that down with some easy optimization to actually 3.7 seconds, which is pretty cool. Memory allocation peaks out at 3 megabytes at a time. So the proof of concept code consists of about 1,500 lines of stuff. This includes basic iterate construction, combinators, and several examples. The memory management happens transparently by a bespoke garbage collector. And in fact, adapting the memory management to hard constraint environments, such as device drivers, embedded systems, etc., is one of the things for the future. Also high on the to-do is a larger case study before the POC can be turned into a proper library. Finally, you can find all this stuff at this address that includes all the code, the slides to this talk, some docs I hope to add, hopefully today, as well as the slides to a longer version of this talk that was given a few weeks ago. And finally, if you'd like to, if you have any feedback, if anybody has any suggestions or thinks this is a great or a stupid idea, please do send it to me at this email address. And I'm a bit fast, I suppose. Because that's great. It. Thanks.
Thank you.
Hiya. Hi there, I'm Michael. I'm from MetaLab in Vienna, and this talk is going to be about an arbitrary TCP connection from the ClearNet to a hidden service. So I hope you're all familiar with Tor hidden services. If you're not, Tor to Web is a way to connect to a location anonymous service, which basically enables the people that provide some content or some website anyway to stay anonymous in contrast to the user. Tor to Web doesn't really secure the user from being de-anonymized when looking at a certain content. So I was interested in basically having that ClearNet connection, a transparent proxy to an arbitrary hidden service, saying, for example, to do TLS handshakes with an onion from the ClearNet, enabling safe transport and storage, as you can read, And the way that I wanted to do it is to have a very tiny virtual private server with, I don't know, 128 megabytes of RAM that doesn't have anything on it except for configuration files and maybe public SSH keys. So how about going proof of concept? HTTPS servers are so easy to set up that would be boring, but I actually have a use case. I want to store my email in an anonymous location because, hey, you never know when law enforcement drops by and forces your provider to hand over the machine, and in some certain jurisdictions, you are also obliged to provide the password for the full disk encryption. So throw your hands up in the air for SMTP. Yeah, I hate it too. But anyway, the actual configuration is awkwardly simple. It's really for the Tor configuration on the transparent proxy side. It's three lines, and it's only two if you don't use Tor to web mode, which drops half of the circuit for a hidden service connection, which basically makes it faster. And if you want more ports and more services on the same connection, you can just use that with IP tables rerouting to the same port. So here you go. That works. I have a localhost connection from an actual ClearNet server. It's all ECDHE, so ephemeral, private, ephemeral, and perfect forward secret. So it's such dark, very hackathon, much hide. Location anonymous saving for email, that's great. But I also would like to have outgoing connections. But we don't want to be spam, so what we're actually trying to do is send our email out of the same machine that we use as a transparent proxy. So we're gonna do SSH. We're gonna use SSH for a SOX proxy. And there is this wonderful little application, which I'm not quite sure how to trust, but Red Sox enables transparent proxying over SOX. So that's fun. But wait, shit, Tor doesn't support MX records, and PostFix fucks up if it doesn't get UDP requests for DNS. And we also don't want the hidden service that we're running to leak DNS records. So there is this, I don't know how dodgy it is. It's from JT Ripper on GitHub. But it's enabling basically, a DNS SOX proxy, which you can then place regular UDP DNS requests over a SOX proxy. Well, that's great. So let's do some more IP tables fun. And all of a sudden, there, I fixed it.
30 seconds.
So yeah, fun. I have an outgoing connection from my hidden service, transport secured, and hello there from the darknet. Many location anonymous, such secure, very spam workaround. Wow. So yeah, there's some issues, there's some future, and that's it.
And 5 minutes is yours.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Volker Grabsch, and I want to present to you a small tour that I wrote some time ago. It's called Bitcoin Proof. It's a kind of digital notary, so I think I have to explain what this means. The idea is to kind of use or misuse the Bitcoin network as a way to timestamp your data, so that you can prove afterwards that this piece of data existed at a certain point in time. For example, you have a new flat, you make some pictures and there was some damage, and afterwards you want to prove that this damage existed when you moved to this flat, and you can simply do this if you can prove that this picture had this time and was not created afterwards. And this is not so much surprising because the whole Bitcoin network exists to ensure this kind of timestamping. The only difference is that they timestamp transactions and not other kinds of data. So, but it's still possible to plug other data into the Bitcoin network, and this is what this tool is about. So this allows you to save some money for a notary that you would have to hire otherwise. The tool is quite simple. You can put in your data. Note that everything is calculated on JavaScript side, so nothing is uploaded. But if you don't trust me, just calculate your SHA-256 checksum offline and then copy this into there. It will work too. And this from this one, it's a Bitcoin address is calculated to which you can put any amount of money, so as few as possible, of course, and because you almost certainly won't get it back. If you put in some new data, you will see, you will get an address and it will tell you, this is not known, so you can create this timestamp. This is a simple link to this Bitcoin address where you can put some minimum amount of money. And in the other case, it shows you, I found this in a Bitcoin network, there was a transaction to that account with that number and at that point in time. So no need to put any more money on it, just this is your proof. And of course you can, this is just a convenience feature, you can calculate everything on your own if you want to prove it. There's also another tool that isn't mentioned in the slides. It's a nice Android app by some different person, Ligi. He called his tool Satoshi Proof, which is compatible with this one. And the basic idea is that this SHA checksum is the checksum of your, normally is your checksum of your public key of your Bitcoin account, but the network doesn't make any assumptions on the structure of this public key. So it can be the checksum of any kind of data, and that's what I'm using here. If you want to do this little hack with a real bank account, of course you can use the purpose field and put any text in you want, but you can't do this in Bitcoin, so I have to misuse the Bitcoin address for that. There's also a nice idea for an extension that isn't implemented yet. It's to not to use this checksum to create the fake public key, but to create the private key, which would allow you to get this money back after this fake transaction. Of course, the question is whether two times the transaction fee is worth the trouble of moving this minimum amount of that, of money. So you would still have to decide on your own. Yeah, and that's it. Please have a look at it, and I'm happy to get any feedback or help or tell me if it was useful for you. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, and you see your slides there too, in front, right?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. 5 minutes is yours.
Okay. Hi, so let me introduce myself to you first. I'm Nick, I am 23 years old, and on paper I am a student in linguistics and information science, but this is a bit vacant because of the several projects I am doing in the area of open source projects and such things. But this is not all too important, because what I want to present today is an organization that we founded only this year, and this is TechIt. So the first question I want to answer is, what is this TechIt thing? And first of all, we are a German nonprofit organization, and we have consolidated several projects in the area of youth work. So we started out with a, why doesn't this, I'm a bit confused. Okay, so we started out with a holiday camp we ran at the FOSCON, which is a FOSS event in St. Augustine near Bonn. And after that, we picked up the work on several other projects. One of these things is a partner network. The core of our project is a strong network of projects and people and also companies that share our goals. And one thing is, for example, when we are building a network between companies and, for example, students, then maybe we can get these students into internships that are a bit more exciting than the average stuff you get when you are a school kid. Okay, I already mentioned the holiday camp we ran. This is a short impression of this event. The idea is that we integrate the kids into the whole of this event. Not only do they attend it, but they also run it. And the reason is that we want, as a central goal, build up a community among youngsters. Just as we did through many years in among us hackers, we also want to port this community to youngsters. I will go into detail about this in a few seconds. Okay. There are a few projects we plan to run in the near future. One of this is we want to build a communication platform. Nothing really new. We just want to put together all that stuff that is already there. But we have found that most free alternatives and most free software is not as attractive for school kids as it should be, and we do not blame this on the open source projects because they have different things to do. So we want to be some kind of glue between the young community and the open source projects to help them make their software and their services more attractive for the young members of the community. And there's also another point where we need to network because we do some negotiation with parents and teachers and all this. There are two worlds that clash a bit because one thing is, of course, parents have an obligation to care. They need to know what their kids do on the internet, of course. But this does not mean that basic civil rights like telecommunication secrecy
1 minute.
Does not exist for minors. We need to care about this to get these two things under one hat. Okay, why do children need an open source community? This is fairly easy. You all know why we need an open source community, because we need to get together on topics that matter, both technical and social. So we need to help youngsters to build up such a community as well, because they do not have the possibilities to do this on their own, like we did or are doing. Okay, I need to hurry a bit. Acceptance of free software in education must grow. This is, Okay. If you really feel the urge to support us, drop by at our booth. We are on ground one in the corner. Thank you.
Oh, I think French Tech, did you want to come talk for a second? Okay, yeah, sure. Do you mind letting French Tech come in, because he just baked us a whole bunch of chocolate chip cookies? Oh well, explain which cookies you had, and
can I have 2 minutes?
You brought cookies. I think that's a pretty good bribe for the audience. No one's ever done better than that in the history of the Lightning Talk. So we'll start handing out these cookies, and Your time lasts as long as the cookies do. How about that? Go for it.
Thank you very much. My name is Frederick Algodor-Apfelbeck, and I am food hacker and biotechnologist, Kvasir if you like. I am interested in things which support the hacker movement in a way which is sustainable and connected to the food and beverages. You may know the food hacking-based project, which I am involved with for the last few years, and which actually Nick helped to start a long time ago in a way in a camp in Finofurt. We move on from the camp to camp to the congress to congress. In this moment, we have several crowdsourcing campaigns after behind ourselves. We managed to grow our community, build up portals online, and work on the projects which we think should happen. Our belief is that combining the ancient knowledge of fermentation and today's scientific understanding and technology, it's a very good idea and it's important. Most of the people here knows a lot about the technology and science. Many of you, unfortunately, forgot a bit about the connection with nature, with the life and things like that. So we are trying to be in together. So the community is around the table together enjoying. At the moment, we, for the first time, managed to actually build the food hacking hub here on the Congress, where you could come, take a workshop, all based on donation, no one turned away off the lack of funds. We managed to experiment the kitchen, running water, experiment the incubator, experiment the fridge, and many other things. I hope that you had managed to talk to us and take some of our lessons. If not, you will have a chance on the next Congress, where we are very likely to grow, and we hope to provide better and better environment, not just here, but through our activities, build up a scheme which could be applied for activities of this type, DIY bio, food hacking, beverage hacking, on conferences and in hacker communities all around the world. I would like to thank you for your time. I think the cookies are nearly gone, so it will be time to go.
This is your last call for cookies. I think they're about done.
Yes. Thank you very much for your attention. Please keep in touch. And last announcement, we are just starting another crowdsourcing campaign and a tour around Europe for the next 6 weeks around hackerspaces all around. Thank you very much, and thank you very much, Nick, for the
thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, thank you for... So what did you guys think of the cookies? All right, so thank you for letting us have that, and 5 minutes is yours.
Hello, my name is McLemon. I'm with the Meta Lab in Vienna. We've heard a lot about crypto and hardening services, the crypto party movement teaching the crypto tools to everyone, how good implemented TLS can thwart a lot of sneaky three-letter acronym organizations from eavesdropping on our traffic. So there's the Better Crypto Project, and it's all these things are based around a simple idea, which is no more plain text. We encrypt everything. All the traffic has to be encrypted. So we've created the definitive guide to applied crypto hardening for your servers. And we're targeting system administration, so if you're administering a server or a cloud or something like that, this guide is for you. So if you go to bettercrypto.org, what can you find there? The scope of the document currently covers testing, so you can see how good or bad actually is your server at this moment, with easy ratings as well. We cover web servers like Apache, LightTTP, Nginx, of course. We cover mail servers. You're running Postfix, Exim, Dovecot, Cyrus, we get you covered. We're talking about key lengths. What is the minimum key length you should use today? What shouldn't you use anymore? And if you have a high security application, where should you move on to? We're covering algorithms. Which cryptographic algorithms should you not use anymore? We've heard a lot about RC4 being broken. Don't use that anymore. We tell you what's best to use at this moment. Random number generators. All your crypto can go pretty much down if you have bad random numbers. And not every dice roll should give you a 4. We hope you're using VPNs. We're giving advice on L2TP, IPsec, OpenVPN. The PPTP section is very short. It's basically don't.
Also proprietary stuff like Cisco ASA.
Yeah, not only open source, we even care for commercial products. Yeah, you're using SSH to administer your server and you never can know enough about SSH. So here's how to harden your SSH servers. Of course, GPG is a well-known and respected tool we all use. Instant messaging, it happens. You can do a lot in improving instant messaging security, databases, encryption of databases. And when you go there, you find tested configurations. You can just copy-paste them from the document into your server configuration. This is what it looks like, probably. You don't need to photograph that now. It's in the document. We want you to participate in this project. You can help us with reviewing the contents. If you're good in cryptography, cryptanalytics, if you're a sysadmin, test these things. We have done a lot of testing, but we cannot cover every aspect and every situation that is in the field. Some parts are missing. We have a huge wish list of topics we would like to cover in this document. Please help us write them. And most importantly, deploy the hard crypto. If you have seen Jacob Applebaum's talk about deep packet injection, he said TLS can mitigate this threat, and also the eavesdropping. Deploy this. It's not that hard. It's usually a few lines to copy to improve your crypto. So go to the website. You can fork us on GitHub, of course. Join the mailing list, all the discussions and reviewing, and each addition to the document gets a review. This is how we do quality control. We have a repository. Clone that. You can see the complete creation of the document from the first creation of an empty file, with including every typo we made. The whole process is transparent from the beginning on, and we want to keep it that way. Download one the PDF, go to bettercrypto.org, and if you have questions, we're around here. We're on Twitter on bettercrypto, as well as app.net. Join us, deploy hard crypto, and come to us. Thanks.
Oh, don't bring your microphone down a little, just in, yeah, up just a tiny bit. Yeah. Okay. And 5 minutes, slide is down there. 5 minutes is yours.
Okay, hi. I'm going to talk about something that happened during the Tunisian Revolution that wasn't very widely publicized, and I feel that it deserves more attention because GCHQ and NSA are not the only surveillance organizations that we have to worry about. Basically, during the Ben Ali dictatorship, the Tunisian government were actively harvesting the usernames and passwords of Gmail and Facebook users by injecting malicious JavaScript into the login pages. So basically, in Tunisia, there's one big ISP that's run by the state, and for quite a while now, they've used this software made by a San Francisco company called SmartFilter, which essentially allows them to censor and monitor all the internet traffic that goes through this ISP. So this is the actual code that they were injecting through a man-in-the-middle attack in the Facebook login page. And if you look carefully, you'll actually see that for some reason they're using leetspeak in their JavaScript functions and variables. So basically what this code does is when you hit the login button, it sends your username and password over plain text to a URL at Facebook. So that way they can intercept it and get your username and password. Now, the reason why they can't just use a tool like SSL strip to replace HTTPS with HTTP is because Facebook actually doesn't allow logins through HTTP. So they have to do it like this. So this was a very simple browser add-on that I released that a Tunisian could install to basically strip out those JavaScript functions in the Facebook login page. And it was downloaded over 4,000 times, so hopefully that someone found that helpful. So I think the lesson here is that I really don't think that right now the way browsers are implementing HTTPS is secure at all. I think it makes HTTPS almost useless. I would propose that if a browser knows that a website is using HTTPS or has HTTPS enabled, then it should completely disable and block all HTTP connections to that website. So a man-in-the-middle attack wouldn't be possible, because right now the user doesn't really have a choice to use HTTP or HTTPS. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Tim, and I've written a piece of code you might care for or not. Let's see, it's called Sharing Secrets, and it's a networked password manager. What does network mean? It can store password, of course, but it can share passwords. Yeah, it's a bad idea. It's insecure, but many people practice sharing passwords. And these passwords get sent per mail from one person to another, and that's really bad. So the sharing secrets can share passwords with a right click, and if any person which has access to the password changes the password, every person connected gets the update, and everybody has the password which is the newest. It can also be used for encrypted password distribution with read-only accounts. And of course, since it is a client-server model, you can have multiple instances on as many computers as you like, and it doesn't run into synchronization issues. Another thing is you can make digital testimonies. For example, if you have a root account for your server, and it's an important server with an important service, and you get run over by a car and you die, your server can't be accessed and cannot be maintained. And with the digital testimonies, you can encrypt your password with the keys for multiple people. And these people combined can access your password, but not a single person alone. Another thing is, if a password gets changed, it doesn't get overwritten. You always can view the old status, so you don't lose anything. And you don't have to decide which server you use. You can set up your own and use any other server you want. So how does it work? Well, this. Side button. sorry. So what does sharing passwords really mean? Every user can have partners, which is a bit like a trusted user group. And there's an invite system where you can invite other people to be your partner. And if they say it's OK, you're partners. If you're partners, you can share your password with a right click. And if on a change of the password, every one of the partners gets a notification and stores the new password. A big thing is that every item, a password key or something, can be shared individually. So if you have 10 passwords, you can share only one password and leave the other 9 private. This means that there are no big crypto containers with passwords stored in it. So there are almost no synchronization issues. There are several different kinds of sharing supported. The normal sharing is read-write sharing. But you can also say, let's make a read share, so people can only read the password but not change it. Or a write-only share, for example, for external applications. So this means an external application can write into your password manager, but not read anything. So how does it work in principle? Everything you do, really everything you do, like saving a password, is a message. And each message is encrypted by GPG, so it should be safe on the crypto level. And these messages are sent to a server, which then relays and stores these messages. Since these messages are completely encrypted by GPG, the server doesn't know anything about the user state.
1 minute.
And this, since it's server-based, it doesn't matter if your partner is online or not. The messages can be requested from the server again, so if you fuck up, delete your passwords, you can just ask your server, hey, send me everything again. The testimony passwords were mentioned
30
already.
30 seconds.
So where can you help? I need code, I need testing, I need ideas and security advice, and you can reach the project page and with sharing secrets, you can reach me with this email address. Yeah, so done.
Hi, my name is Sven. I'm from hackerspace called Makratea Laboratories from Fulda. And together with Dustin, who's in the audience here, we wrote a tool called DD Server that we are running at our hackerspace. DD Server is a tool used for dynamic DNS management. What does that mean? DNS allows you to have dynamic zones where you have subdomains or hostname records that you can update dynamically. Why would you need this? Because you're sitting on a DSL uplink, changing your IP address frequently. For example, at Telekom every night, you get a new IP address and you still want to have host names or domain names that you can use as a static name for your home server, for example. Such services are available by now, called DynDNS, for example, or NoIP. So why did we implement a new one? Because maybe many of you know what happened with DynDNS. They started with a number of host names, then they reduced the number of host names you can use, then they got to a, you have to log in every now and then or we kill your account, and now they are a paid service. And McFly from Darmstadt gave a great talk on how to run your, or called run your own fucking infrastructure to get rid of such happenings. So we started that own service, and when we started, there was no such thing. Now we know that there is another service called nsupdate.info. The guys are sitting in the hack center as we do. We both implemented the same idea, but we did it on different ways. What we did is we wrote a Python program. The other project is also written in Python, called DD Server. It consists of three parts. The DD Server update, the DD Server interface, what is in the middle here is a nice looking web interface where you have some basic user management. You can define DNS zones where the host names go in, and users can add their host names. We have the DD Server updater, what is in the middle top. What is the REST interface that implements the DynDNS2 protocol? So this is the protocol that's also used by DynDNS or NoIP. For updating the IP address of your host. As it's the DynDNS protocol, every Fritzbox, every DDWRT or OpenWRT router can use this. Or a tool called DD Client, if you are on a Linux machine, can also send updates to that tool. And we have the DD Server Recursor, which is a small Python program that is executed by the PowerDNS server using the pipe backend of PowerDNS, which gets the IP address of some host name back and allows PowerDNS to give you out the IP address of the host name you're querying for. The whole thing can run in a redundant setup, so you can just mirror the database and run the DD server recursor on the second server with the replicated database to have a backup DNS server. All the tools can be installed on different servers, or you can just run it as the whole thing on the right side on one server. This is how the web interface looks like. It's implemented with the Bootstrap layout. That's very common. The project homepage is ddserver.cyrix80.io. There is some basic documentation. We have to do further documentation of the project, I guess. The project is on GitHub. There is an email address where you can reach us. I would be happy to get some feedback, maybe feature requests or bug reports. Tell us what you think about the tool. And again, the info, the NS update project is also on GitHub, and I think they will also be happy to get any feedback you have. Thank you very much.
All right, and now we have our final lightning talk. I hope that's the correct version. We have our final lightning talk of the 30C3. So,
sir.
Next to the mic. Yeah, there you go.
Okay, I'm
so we have our final lightning talk of the 30C3, and you know we're only going to end up half an hour over time. So, huge round of applause for everybody who is involved in this process. All of the speakers, the angels, yep. It's a lot of fun for me, and we're just going to clear the stage right after Christine's talk. So thank you for showing up, and think about submitting a lightning talk for next year. So without any further ado, you've got 15 minutes. Go.
Okay, hi. When I submitted this talk, I had a very different mindset. First of all, the talk was originally intended to be an hour long, and they didn't accept it, so I'm here.
Closer to the microphone, please.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, tying down to a microphone. So what I'm really focusing on is the legislative process. I tried to change the law. As an individual, as a hacker, because hackers change things, and I'm in Silicon Valley, and what you do is you come up with great ideas, and you buy yourself and build steam, you implement them. Well, government doesn't work that way. So I spent a lot of time figuring out how you would go about changing the law. And I learned a whole lot along the way. It was pretty interesting. A lot of Washington insiders, a lot of Brussels insiders, and I imagine some insiders in Berlin are aware of some of these issues. But I think it's useful to think about for hackers, because once you understand a system, you can figure out ways to get around it. And this is a system that needs to be gotten around. So why legislation? I started this project to change the law, but what needs to happen, or it's an important democratic process that's kind of gotten subverted. We all talk about voting when we talk about democracy, but voting isn't what changes your life. Voting gets people in, and those people you get in are supposed to change your life, but that's not happening. Elections and lawmaking, they're not the same thing. Most voters don't really consider the breadth of all the issues that will come before the legislator when they elect them. And voting just doesn't get you any laws. It just puts somebody in there that you have to place some faith in that they'll do what you want. And that's not happening. Legislators have, they don't have money, they don't have, I've been talking to people in the last month in the EU about the situation here, thinking that you guys were much more together. And it's like, no, we're in the same boat. It's worse in the United States, but it's about the same worldwide. The same things are happening, the same failures are going about. So you have a bubble forming around your centers of power, because people who want power for power's sake, not because they want to serve. There are a few people who want to serve who have ideologies that they're forwarding, but there's this quest for power that we cannot ignore. And it clouds, it obfuscates getting the real technical good people in for advice. It hides the ball, basically, when you're trying to get good answers. So I've identified some of the reasons why. So what it takes to change the law, you need a dedicated full-time presence at the site of the legislator. In the US, DC, or in California, Sacramento, Berlin, even if you want your own directives at the EU, in Brussels. So you have to be there, you have to have feet on the ground all the time. You have to, lobbyists are paid a tremendous amount of money because they can bring home the bacon for the big companies. Seven figures to schmooze congressmen. Most of them are former congressmen or former MPs other agency ministry heads come in and so it takes quite a bit to get there but more than anything else, more than this feet on the ground, more than the real glad handing, it takes patience and dedication, which is something I'll get to a little later, but it's something that is really hard for this community, for most ordinary day-to-day people to do, is these long-term
10 minutes.
Thanks. 2, 3, 4, 5 year programs that other organizations do. So this is how corporations succeed. They hire the MPs. They hire the former congressmen, and they write their own bills. That's what we were trying to do. We were trying to write our own bill, and. Part of that is there's a lot of overhead in the United States, you have to know all the case law, you have to know all the interpretations, all the opinions on that particular piece of legislation and its history and who's edited it before and why and what was wrong with it before, why did they edit it and all these other things. And so there's a lot of knowledge behind that. And all this knowledge is kind of locked away in this language, this highly legalistic language that even law people don't always, can't always wrap their head around. So they have the expertise to do that, and they have the long-term vision. They commit 3-6 year programs to change legislation in their favor. But you can't imagine how long the, say, motion picture industry has been working on copyright law and just really seriously focusing on that. Telecommunications companies are also big lobbyists. A big government in the United States, again, this is really a bad problem, mostly because our central federal government has a lot of money. I've been talking to a lot of people and trying to figure out why Brussels is the place where you send politicians to die and Washington is a place politicians aspire to. And a lot of that probably has to do with money. But they have all that money goes to pay agencies and specialists and professionals, and these professionals are going to be anticipating challenges that their agency could potentially face. And so when a crisis occurs, they slap down legislation that gives them everything they ever wanted. And so that, by being ready, by being knowledgeable, and by being in touch with Congress and trusted by Congress or Parliament, then they have the ability to come in and propose legislation that can get moved through fairly quickly. You might notice, I didn't mention it before, but both these scenarios involve the proposer or the interested party proposing their own legislation. Legislators don't write legislation. This is true in the United States. This is true here in Europe. And different people, there are more government permanent employees writing legislation in Europe than there are in the United States. This is something I was surprised to discover. But lobbying for corporate interests is huge in the United States, and I see the trickling in Europe as well, where you have professional lobbyists, you have everybody coming in and doing that. So nobody ever questions the authority of the government officials, so they can usually get a lot of stuff through, even if their tech is bad. So public interest, the EFF, in United States, there's all sorts of different grassroots political organizations that purport to represent the people. And they exist, I'm sure, here too, but you guys are much better organized, having spoken with them. A lot of these organizations are really directed at the people, not at the parliamentarians, not at the members of Congress or Parliament. They are focused on keeping the people interested, excited, and donating money. It's not that their goal is to donate money, but it's to keep people and the cause alive. And they're not necessarily so good at actually achieving results. So they tend to be more reactive than proactive. Like the last two, the long-term planning of the corporate and the anticipatory preparation of the government.
5 minutes.
So public interest is failing mostly because people have shifting goals and desires. We're responding every week to a new Snowden revelation, and every week there's a different interest in changing the law, and it might be something different. And it's good that the Snowden revelations have been spaced out, so at least that interest has stuck with us for a while. But we live in a land of sound bites, and what is important to us changes from week to week. So it's very difficult to have the long-term persistence that would be required to actually see laws all the way through to completion. It's a process that takes anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. Very rarely can you get legislation in place in less than a month anywhere. So, yeah, can we do better? What can we do? What I want to see is I want to see an opportunity for individuals who are passionate about a single issue to be able to come together and build something, build support, build long-term support, because they're passionate about this issue, and hold on to it and continue to work on it week after week, after month after year, and protect their interests. It takes a lot. There's a lot of legislation going on. There's a lot of a tremendous amount of laws being enacted every day. So it has to be an individual interest thing. Advocacy groups are great at really general stuff, and I support pretty much everything this group does, but no one thing are you especially passionate about. I'd like to enable people to roll their own, to not have to rely on a preset organization to create the change that you're looking to create. So as a result, I am trying to build this website, social network, organization, something called Fork the Law, to to enable people to come together to research the background on the law, to figure out and translate it into plain English and get all the information together so that experts in a specific field that are trusted experts by everybody else in their field, not just the Washington insiders or the insiders, to get everybody involved and to get something built that say we can change the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We can change any particular piece of legislation
1 minute.
That you want to have changed. So I think I am finishing early. If you would like to see, if you would like to talk more with me about this, or if you're passionate about changing the law and enabling individuals to pursue their goals, I like to get people together for a kind of workshop-y thing downstairs at the Milliways table in the back room. So you can come see me there, and I would like to talk to you later.